the number of jobs. So for example, we find out in Houston that they're hiring 100,000, maybe 50,000 workers are going to hire them. And it's going to be in the oil and gas industry. Well, you can go and you can take the nice NACCS, the NAI, CCS, that, you know, that breakdown of employees you have by their different codes.
Right.
And you can say, okay, well, this is Houston's current profile. This is the national profile of those same jobs. And, you know, so you can see which areas Houston is in. And you know, obviously Houston is strong in oil and gas. And so those 50,000 jobs are going to have a certain number of additional jobs they're going to add and a certain number of population growth they're going to create.
Your network is your net worth. Come listen to some of the most successful people I know. Share invaluable knowledge, stories, and advice in real estate, business, and beyond. This is Weiss Advice. Whether you want to take your business or personal life to the next level, look no further. Welcome back to Weiss Advice. I'm your host, Yonah Weiss. Today, I am very happy and grateful to be joined by Joseph Bramante. Thank you so much, Joseph, for joining me all the way from Houston. Well, I'm actually virtually in Houston also, if you see the background over here. But it's great to have you on the show.
Hey, Yonah. Great to be here. And thanks for the rush and getting me on the show.
Yeah, well, this is definitely a pleasure. I'm glad we made it work and get you on the show. I know you had last week, this is already going to be airing a few months from now, but last week you had you were supporting your wife in Miami for like a game show, something that some sort of competition.
She's a finalist on The Boss, so go check her out. And it was a really cool experience. And so I wasn't in the right headspace to even be on any show.
Yeah, I totally get that. Even if it was like in a hotel room or whatever, it's still not, you're not in the headspace, you know, to do it. So just a little background on Joseph to give everyone, I'd like to give everyone a little bit of a context. He is, you know, has a background in civil engineering, went into real estate about, you know, 7-8 years ago, and he's had an incredible experience now developing and buying multifamily properties in Houston, where he's located, and has a big goal, right? You're setting big goals for yourself and you're calling them out. That's what I love. You know, you're really setting the goals, the sights high, and you want to take over, you know, want to be the next biggest property developer in Houston, Texas. So lofty goals. And I just appreciate that, you know, you're taking the time out, and I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got from civil engineering to, you know, to multifamily real estate.
Yeah. So the path for me into multifamily was a little unusual in that I just kind of jumped right in, you know. So in engineering, you get used to teaching yourself stuff. The courses, the teachers always teach everything. They give you these exams and they're like, well, it was in the book. Did you read the book? And like, it doesn't matter if we covered it in class or not. So the expectation is that you learn, I think the term is called autodidact, where you learn to read a book and teach yourself in that book. Well, I read like 6 or 7 books on multifamily, felt pretty confident that, you know, I had the concepts down. They seemed pretty simple at first. And so me and a friend, we pooled our money together and give you guys the cliff notes, right? There's a lot more detail, but the cliff notes are that we pooled our money together and we bought an apartment complex. And the reason I actually went into apartment in general is because prior to that, all my managers, to make this story 3 or 4 times more interesting, I'm actually not living in America at the time. I'm living in Papua New Guinea, which is a little tiny island about 4 hours by plane north of Australia. So it's on the other side of the world.
Wow.
And so all my managers, I'm living there full time. My managers are rotating back and forth every 4 weeks. It just felt like every time they would come back, they had a new rental property that they had just purchased. They're buying these really crappy apartment houses, or sorry, not apartment houses, rental houses. They're like 30 or 40 grand and would go and brag to all of us about these houses they bought. And so anyway, I was trying to buy these houses myself. I said, great, they can buy them, I can buy them. So I went out and had this big, beautiful spreadsheet, and I was going to try and buy 80 foreclosed houses with me and another friend who had already bought like 5 houses. And I'm not sure how we got to 80, but 80 was the number. And we kept sending this spreadsheet to all these banks. And this is 2010. So the economy had just kind of, the housing crisis is just fresh on everybody's minds. We're just coming out of it. And so from there, we went and they obviously just kept telling us no, because of course
you didn't have the experience.
I have the experience. I'm asking for $3 million to buy these houses. And, you know, for us, it's common sense. No, but anyway, I don't know. One banker finally said, just go buy an 8-unit apartment complex. Like, and that was like the light bulb. And then from there, I went and read the books. And from there, I found a partner, another Exxon friend, because my first Exxon friend wasn't brazen enough to go in with me on these apartments. So we went and we bought a small 26-unit apartment complex, sight unseen, while living in Papua New Guinea. And that was our intro into multifamily.
Wow. So you really got like, you just jumped right in. You know, you didn't have any of these like mentoring programs or any of these kind of, you know, training or courses or anything like that.
No, just 26, a lot of confidence and engineering background. And I guess also just, I felt a little bit invincible because at that time, again, working overseas, we're making very high salary from Exxon. And so, you know, we're like, what could this small little apartment complex do to the two of us combined? Right. Like we got this covered. Then as the story progresses, I end up, you know, 6 months into the deal, and I'll stop at 6 months, but 6 months into the deal, we find out that the property, that we don't have insurance, that we purchased fraudulent insurance.
Oh my goodness.
That the property has asbestos, and then I end up losing my job. So three big things happen all in a 6 month period. And we're renovating. We have four units down that we're renovating, and then we get notice that we have asbestos. So we've lost 15% of the units on the property.
Wow.
And so very quickly things can turn around on you. And all of a sudden multifamily commanded my respect. And I was now in a position of really, it was more of a survival thing for me. Mm-hmm. I had no ambitions of knocking out of the park or anything like that. I had just lost my job. I had sunk the majority of what I'd made while working for Exxon into that deal. Mm-hmm. And now I was about to lose that deal. So I was basically going to be starting over after 5 years of working with nothing. And wow. So that was the situation I was in that I was trying to protect. And then fast forward 3 years, we do a massive 30,000 per door renovation, kind of something similar to what you see behind me. This is a 37,000 a door renovation behind me. But we did a 30,000 on my first one, 200% return, knock out of the park, still in it today. Wow. And that was how I got started.
Wow. So fast forward to today, 2020, right? You and your team, you're buying multifamily properties. Are you still in the, you know, doing new development, or are you taking down and doing value add, you know, kind of renovations of properties?
No, I mean, new development's new for us. We actually just had meetings yesterday with the architects, and we've been working on a 400 to 500 unit garden style new development out in tertiary market outside of Houston for the last 3 to 4 years. And it's finally, we're going for city approvals in about 3 weeks. So we're really excited about that and just seeing everything come together. And I tell you, when you've worked on something for so long, you get a little bit emotional, you know, like when I saw the site maps as they mm-hmm. really, like they're at a level of maturity now that you can really start to see it and feel the property come alive. Wow. And, you know, it takes you back because it's been like, that's another engineering degree. I could have had an engineering degree, another one, and this is all in one project.
Wow. So that project, let me ask you, that you've been in the works for 3-4 years, and I mean, it's a huge, huge project. When, you know, if approvals go through in 3 weeks, like when would you be breaking ground on that?
End of the year.
End of the year
or first part of next year.
Incredible. Incredible. So then you're going to taste something entirely new. So why new development over, you know, just buying existing buildings?
Well, back in 2016, we saw the spread between Class A and value add really start to diminish. And it was only a matter of time before it was just going to make more sense from a risk perspective, just to build something new, because what the thing that value add has over Class A is, or sorry, the thing that Class A has over value add is the risk profile. The risk is much less on new product versus going in, buying something old, renovating it. There's all kinds of stuff you end up finding behind the walls. So we just felt like, plus there's that, what's that term, flight to quality, you know, with Class A, I mean, if you can do it, then it makes a lot more sense just to build something. You get those strong returns. So it's like doing a value add and then having a brand new product at the end.
Yeah.
So you take that upfront risk, you get the big pop in returns, and you're now long-term holding a brand new product.
Yeah, that makes sense. And there's obviously, you know, when anyone's doing any type of investment, there's tons of research that goes into it, right? Tons of and experience along the way. And I'm sure you've learned a tremendous, like you said, like a new degree, not just in the time factor, but in actually all that you've learned and picked up along the way in the process of doing it.
Right. Yeah, no, and that was what took so long. It shouldn't have taken us this long, but we're learning, you know, and there's no real roadmap. I mean, how many podcasts have you seen on new development or books about how to do new development?
Yeah.
It's still very much, I don't know, it's like a good old boys network of developers out there. There's not a whole lot of people doing it. And the ones who are doing it, they're not telling you how. So you got to reach out to them and partner with them and, you know, and figure out how to do it.
Absolutely. What would you say has been your biggest challenge in that, you know, and, you know, kind of being, I guess, like a lighthouse for the future? Because you said there aren't people like going out talking about this. And that, let's say you're the one that's, you know, people are going to be listening to on this. What are some of the challenges that you had throughout the process that you can kind of give some advice for those who might be looking into that space?
You know, part of the challenges is the roadmap isn't very clear, right? There's no kind of, you do this, here's step one, step two, step three, step four. It's very much a blank canvas and you're having to create everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire development process is an iterative one. It's a circle. So you will do, you know, do a market analysis, and then you'll go and you'll do kind of a financial model. Then you'll look at the profile, and then you'll come back to the financials of what it costs. And then you've got the whole land planning side of things where you're looking at your site map, and your site map, you'll only be able to fit so many buildings, so many units. And you go back to the financial model, rerun the model for the new account. And so it's just a constant back and forth versus when you're doing acquisition, for example, it's a lot of the variables are set. You know what you're getting into. Right. And it's a very kind of step one, step two, step three kind of process to doing. There is some iteration, but not nearly as much as there is with new development. And that's what's taken so long is, you know, we've probably had, no exaggeration, over 100 different site maps for this one development. And we've been on two different locations. So that's been part of the, you know, we had one site for like 2 years, did the full development, due diligence on it, ended up not working because the what we found on the engineering was that we were going to bring about $3 million worth of upfront development for dirt compaction to lift the site up to do a drainage before we even put the foundation. And that was just going to be a deal killer for us. So right. Those are things that I didn't know to look for right away in the beginning. Whereas now, like, you know, having good dirt, good land is very important.
Sure.
It would have saved us 2 years.
Wow. Yeah. That's huge. I mean, that can make or break a deal, like you said. So some of those things, that's a great piece of advice. These are things that you don't even know about, right? When you're looking into buying land and buying a deal and looking at, what about with actually dealing with, you know, the city and different types of the, you know, the municipality, have they been helpful? Have they been, you know, holding things up for you? What's been that experience like?
I think it's, you know, going to be city by city. For us, where we're at, they want the project. They like us. They want the project to go ahead. They've been very helpful. But there are still some areas that are, you know, where we're the big project coming to town, you know? And so we're the kind of the big developers, as weird as that might sound.
Right.
But we're the project for them.
That's and great. So I mean, there's a lot of good news. There's a lot of upside in that, you know, for future deals.
Yeah. And also a lot of pressure to make sure it gets done right. And then also there's a lot of like uncertainty because, you know, we're doing things that are different than other projects. And so we're doing things like they would have been done in other cities. And so we're having to, you know, work with them on, you know, different easements and stuff like that. And planning and zoning process, et cetera. So it's, you know, from one perspective, they're amazing to work with. And then from the other, it's just, the only challenges are that we're in a smaller town that's not used to doing those things. It's not a negative or anything. I'm just saying it's just an obstacle to overcome.
Absolutely. No, and that's great because it will give you the experience, you know, and maybe going to different towns, different places, similar. Once you have that experience, I think it'll be obviously like everything, the second time is going to be, or the third time is going to be much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to give a shout out. I got a partner that I'm working with that's really kind of held our hand on this, Mike Thomas. He's not on LinkedIn or anything, but he's he's around. He's been doing this for 30 years and he's really kind of helped us in our aspirations, because it's, you know, it's one thing to transition and try and do new development, but if you really want to fast track it, it'll help you a lot bit better to partner with somebody who's been doing this for a while. And we did that, and he's really kind of been the providing a lot of direction. I'll say that, because one of my personal issues that I have is, you know, you can, when you're on that sitemap, you can sit there and you can edit these things into infinity. Like you can just constantly tweak things to get it just right. You'll never, before you actually pull the trigger, but there comes a point when you just got to pull the trigger and you got to go. And I'm usually pretty good at doing that on other, like, acquisitions, rehab, value add, no problem. But for some reason, maybe it's just because it's my first and all that, and I'm so, you know, emotionally attached to it, which is a big no-no.
Yeah.
But he's helping, you know, pushing things forward. And it's like, all right, we got to make a decision. We're going. And so anyway, I think anybody will, on their first new development, will probably experience that, where you just kind of get stuck into the details because, you know, it's your first one. We make that mistake that we're not supposed to make, which is getting emotionally attached to deals.
Yeah. And that's always going to happen. But I think, like you said, having someone older and wiser and more experienced on your team and kind of holding your hand and pushing you through is essential to really making the best of any deal. So I saw recently that you took and passed your CCIM. So congratulations on that. And just for our audience, you know, listeners, what is this CCIM designation and why did you go ahead and get that?
So CCIM stands for Certified Commercial Investor Member. It's a designation held by the top 1% of real estate professionals. Historically, it's been mostly commercial brokers that have had it. Although I never really understood the reasoning why. I found out about CCIM through just my own due diligence. When I first got into the industry, one of the first courses I ever took from them was an advanced financial analysis and Excel course. And I took several electives from them, none of which even applied towards the CCIM designation. I probably had, you know, 10 or 20 hours worth of courses with them that nothing even applied to that designation, which I decided to go ahead and get about 2 years ago. So I've been taking courses with them since 2012. And in 2018, I decided to go ahead and get my designation. I got it for a couple of reasons. One was just because I wanted to. I've seen the value in it. Two, I think it gives people, you know, investors a little bit of extra comfort because they know that, you know, if you're a CCIM, you've got, you know, part of getting that accreditation is you got to take, you know, a certain number of courses. You've got to have a certain level of experience and you have to get letters of recommendation. So it's not just a thing where you take some course and you get the pin. No, you actually have to have a portfolio of experience behind you. And so that's why I got it, because it's, you know, people know when they're speaking with you that you've got a certain level of understanding of commercial real estate. And, you know, we all, you know, talk about ourselves like we're experts in the field, but we know that's not the case.
Right. How many people have spent, you know, hundreds of hours, you know, learning and studying to know the things that they know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was them. You know, I'm a big believer in education. I'm actually applying for another accreditation as well, and so we're just constantly moving forward, trying to improve and get better at this craft.
Awesome. What was your favorite course that you took in the CCIM coursework?
I liked the numbers side, but the one that's been really helpful has been their advanced market analysis, where they teach you how to break down the demographics of a market. So, and how to do, what's it called? The EBM, the economic base multiplier, where you're basically taking the number of jobs. So for example, we find out in Houston that they're hiring 100,000, maybe 50,000 workers are going to hire them. And right. It's going to be in the oil and gas industry. Well, you can go and you can take the NICE, NASIS, the NAI, CCS, that, you know, that breakdown of employees you have by their different codes. Right. And you can say, okay, well, this is Houston's current profile. This is the national profile of those same jobs. And, you know, so you can see which areas Houston is in. And you know, obviously, Houston is strong in oil and gas. And so those 50,000 jobs are going to have a certain number of additional jobs they're going to add and a certain number of population growth they're going to create. And so through that marketing course, you can then determine from those jobs the number of total employment jobs it'll create. So like in Houston, it'll probably be like a 2.2 or something multiple. Right. So those 50,000 will probably create, you know, over 100,000. And then you'll see the population growth from that will probably be, you know, maybe, you know, 150, just guessing numbers here. But so you can see from there, and then from the population growth, now you can say, ah, so population means renters. And so I can then correlate, okay, if I see a lot of jobs coming, you can see a lot of population growth, and vice versa. If you see a lot of jobs leaving, you can see the population leaving, and you can see, you know, maybe I should be selling my property right now.
Right. So you can see what, you know, and how that applies to real estate, and especially multifamily specifically, right? You're talking about renters, you're talking about how many people are actually, you know, living there, having jobs there, and can afford to pay rent for those type of assets. So yes. I see that.
It certainly was not my favorite course. I liked the analysis courses a lot better, the underwriting courses. This one was still like, just to get your head around it, it was a bit theoretical and a bit kind of out. The math was super simple, but just getting your head around the concepts was a bit challenging.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I want to just jump right into the final four over here. So we got four questions we ask all of our guests at the end. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on these questions. So the first question I have, Joseph, is, and you already spoke about some of the jobs you've had before, but I always ask, what is the worst job that you had?
I'll tell you the least paying job I've had. I don't want to say it's the worst. And it was actually my last job was my least paying job, which was weirdest. So for like a 2-month period when I was transitioning from engineering oil and gas into multifamily, I worked as a private jet broker for about 2 months. Yeah.
Selling private jets.
I was leasing jets for flights. Leasing. So if you wanted to go fly from here to New York on a private jet, you know, you'd call me and I'd book you on a flight.
Gotcha.
It was, and you could say I was already working in the industry, and you would think, okay, private jets, you get to see who the clients are, you get all these contacts, you can raise money from them. That was kind of my thought process. That didn't even come close to happening. All it was just me, and it's all commission based. And apparently I'm really terrible at sales. I don't know what happened, but it was the least money I ever made. It was a lot of stress and frustration dealing with these clients, and they like to be, have their hand held a little bit and treated a certain way. And it's a stressful job. It's a challenging job. That's for sure. And anyway, just wasn't for me. So I did it for 2 months and just said, you know, I quit. So I went full time multifamily, but it was, you know, it was a great experience, and it was cool to be on the private jets and all that, be around that whole scene, but you know, wasn't for me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you got that knowledge pretty quickly though. 2 months is a long time, but a very short time to know what if you like something or not. So that's awesome. And sales is not for everyone. So it's good that you know that what you're good at, and partnering with other people that are better, especially for real estate and investing. You need to have someone who's really good at sales, you know, to kind of be with the investors and find investors, et cetera, raising capital is sales in a lot of ways. So second question I have for you, if there's a book you've read that's given you a paradigm shift, I'd love to hear about it.
There's a book called The Outliers, and it just talks about timing and, you know, being in the right place, the right time, and all that. And it talks about, you know, some of these big people we know of, you know, like the Bill Gates of the world. And you think, wow, Bill Gates is some brilliant person. And he is a brilliant person. But you also look at the, like, what was going on in the world at that time when he was at his brilliance, you know, and he was one of the first people ever in the world to have access to a computer. He was programming computers before really anybody did.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, he's going to have, you know, he's going to just go on this tangent and blow up in the software industry. And so it's just, it was him and other stories. He's the one that comes to my mind right now. But it was cool hearing about those kind of legends of the industry that we know of in various industries. And once you really get to understand the context of how they became the person they are, then you start to realize, okay, he's not, I mean, they're smart. Yeah. But you know, sometimes we can make people out to be much better and much larger than they are. And you realize, oh, well, he is actually, you know, a lot of us would have made those very same decisions if in that same room. And so it just kind of gives you that context and really helps you understand, okay, it's really important that you're surrounding yourself with the right people and putting yourself in those right situations.
Right.
Because it's not just that skill and understanding, but it's being in the room.
Right.
And that's what creates a lot of that growth.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel very strongly about that. You know, you're who you surround yourself with, being in the right places at the right time is can't be really, you know, understated, because that's so, so important. So I'd love to check out that book. It sounds like a very interesting perspective, which I agree with. So I'd love to, you know, learn a little more about that. So that's awesome. Thank you for that. The outliers. Third question is, what's a skill or talent that you would like to learn? It sounds like you're always learning. So just put another one out there.
Another one is Spanish. You know, the wife speaks Spanish. We've been together for 4 years. I don't speak Spanish. I'm very, very novice at it. I can understand a lot of it because I've had to over the years, and I hear it. I'm surrounded by Spanish, but the actual speaking is a challenging part. And part of that is just, you know, not wanting to sound foolish, because a lot of what we do is, you know, we don't want to look foolish. And anytime you learn any language, you go through a period where you just look and sound foolish.
Yeah.
And so that's probably what's holding me back more than anything. And then it's just the time commitment and being here where you're always speaking English, and then to try and learn another language. You know, she had the same issue when she learned English, but she couldn't learn English when she was in Colombia because everybody was talking to her in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot easier when you're immersed. And I've got a plan. I want to move back there for couple months and just immerse myself in Colombian Spanish and hopefully learn this time, and then take the skill with me back to
absolutely. Yeah, immersion is the ultimate way to just get involved. Just don't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, just don't speak English. You know, be forced English. Not to speak English, and especially if you have people around you that speak it, that are in on it. Not even if they speak English, but don't let them. You know, kind of do it that way.
Yeah.
That's been the best. I had a similar experience. I know a few languages, and so I had a similar experience where I had someone that just, I was with him every single day, and he just wouldn't speak to me in English, right, at all, right? So I just had to force myself to have a conversation, and that's how we did it. Fourth and final question, what does success mean to you?
You know, that's a challenging question, because, you know, to some people, they look at me and they're like, oh, you're so successful, and I'm like, no, I mean, I don't know. And it's, we always punch through these, you know, we get to these levels, and then we set new goals, we go to new levels. And, you know, one of the levels that we've set for ourselves is 20,000 units. So we get to 20,000 units, that'll be a mark of success for us. And for me, just, you know, getting the company there. So I think for now, my target of success is 20,000 units. I've put a very clear set number on it, and our goal is just to get there.
Wow.
But that's from the corporate side, and then just from the family side and the personal side, just, you know, not having to worry about money, where money is never an issue for our family, our future generations. Like that's my intent, is to create enough wealth for my family, my future generations, that they can just focus on living and enjoying and growing what we've created.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And you know, it's very difficult when you're you know, force without people looking at you, but always, obviously got to look inwards and you have to see what that is. But I'm very impressed with that goal. It's a very lofty goal, 20,000. There are very few people, individual or companies, that make that mark. So I love your ambition and wish you much success getting there along the way. And I appreciate your time and spending us with us today.
Absolutely, Anna. We'll talk again.
Okay, thank you. And to our listeners, thanks again for tuning in once again. And remember, the best advice comes only when you ask. Real quick, I have one question for you. Did you like this episode? If you did, I want to ask you a huge favor. See, the biggest thing that helps this podcast grow and that will spread this message to the whole world is that if you leave a review, a rating, and subscribe to the podcast. What that does is it basically tells the platforms that this podcast is out on is that you like my stuff and I'm doing something right. So take a few seconds out of your day, hit that subscribe button, leave a rating or review. I would be extremely grateful. Also, I want to hear from you guys. So I want to hear some feedback. If you have any questions for future episodes, please find me on LinkedIn, send me a DM, a connection request, Yona Weiss, and I'd love to hear from you.